Do you know what the most requested item at homeless shelters all across the country is? It's socks. I didn't know that, and when I found that out, it made me sad. But it also made a lot of sense. At homeless shelters, new clothing is in extremely high demand. This fact is the driving force behind my friends at Bombas. Bombas exists to help support the homeless community and to bring awareness to an underpublicized problem in the United States. Bombas was founded on the philosophy of donating socks to those in need. But it's evolved to go deeper into the community. The more clothing items they sell, the more they donate. As they grow, their giving and community efforts will continue to grow right alongside them. Over 40 million acts of kindness. One purchase equals one donation. How many of us just go to a big box retail store and buy name brand socks without even second guessing it? Imagine if your purchase could support people in this country who need something as basic to us as a pair of warm, comfortable socks. Folks, do me a favor and go to bombas.com. That's BOMBAS.com. Head over and insert the code COMFORT at checkout to get 20% off your first pair of socks. Bombas covers all sizes, features great designs, including their upcoming holiday collection, and you'll be making a purchase that serves a basic human right and truly helps one of the greatest efforts in our country. That's bombas.com. BOMBAS.com. Welcome back to the show, EJ Hammond. Thanks for hanging out tonight. I appreciate this.
Absolutely. Happy to be here.
Tonight, we're going to be talking about, you know, a dark topic and a darker person. But before we get to the subject of tonight's conversation, let's talk a little bit about you. Tell me about your education and your professional background.
Sure. I actually have a bachelor's of arts in Spanish, of all things. Huh. I initially was going to be a Spanish teacher. And then I realized that that really wasn't the direction I wanted my life to go in. And I had known from a very young age that I wanted to write. So I just kind of began doing that on the side while just working, just to pay the bills.
Yeah.
And really through the years, I've just gotten much more interested in crime. And I think that kind of helped direct me as far as what I wanted to write.
Gotcha.
What genre I wanted to write in.
Yeah. What was it about true crime and just in general, before we get to our topic of the night and what you're really known for, why don't we talk about kind of what it was that got you into the genre? I mean, it's such a robust genre. We talk about it from time to time on this show. What was it about true crime in general that was attractive to you, I guess, for lack of a better term?
I think that, first of all, I lived a very sheltered life. And so when I became interested in true crime, I had begun to wonder if someone like a serial killer would have been something I needed to be concerned with. Being a woman, hearing for so many years, you know, watch out, protect yourself.
Yeah.
You need to look out for strangers, don't talk to them. And it started to become problematic enough that I decided, well, let me just look into this. Anytime I'm afraid of something, I always try to learn as much as I can about it. And so that really just kind of drew me into the genre, drew me into reading about serial killers and other types of crime. And that's really where my fascination started, probably about 20 years ago.
Wow. Okay. And you know, we talked offline yesterday, and it's pretty ironic. I mean, we're recording this conversation on the same night that we're releasing part two of our Jack the Ripper series over at Vanished. And I think, you know, I think if there's a running theme that sort of looms over season two of that show, that theme's, you know, it would be escalation. And here you have Jack the Ripper, who many modern serial killers take a, for lack of a better term, an inspiration from. So I think it's fitting that you're here tonight to talk with me about a man that many believe is arguably the most well-known modern-day serial killer of them all. So to kick this off tonight, why don't you tell me how Ted Bundy came into your life? How'd you get involved in this case in particular?
It started when I read, actually, it was the first true crime book that I ever read, was about Ted Bundy. And I'll tell you, it actually started because I was a big fan of the show Married with Children.
Me too.
And the main character is Al Bundy.
Yes.
And I remember watching and thinking, wasn't there somebody else with the same last name who was, you know, involved in crime? And so I just followed that thread and I read Ann Rule's book, The Stranger Beside Me. And that just hooked me. into the whole genre, into the concept of an organized serial killer, a lust serial killer. And from there, I just read everything I could get my hands on as far as serial killers, spree killers, mass killers. I've more recently gotten into assassins and mafiosi, but really Ted is where it started, and Ted is where I still find my focus today.
You mentioned, and before we get into sort of who Bundy was, for the folks who might not know much about him other than the name, you know, other than the pop culture reference, we'll get into that. But you mentioned the term lust serial killer. Can you tell everybody what that means?
When we're talking about a lust serial killer, we're looking at someone who he or she becomes very involved in a fantasy world. And generally that fantasy revolves around their sexuality, objects of their sexual interest. And so they tend to act out those fantasies when they commit their crimes. And generally sex is involved in the crime.
Do we know a percentage of that? It seems like that's a running theme. I mean, and I'm forgive my ignorance, but it seems like that's a running theme in a lot of serial killers' MO is sex. Is that fair to say?
We do find that a great deal of the time with serial killers. So most of them, it seems, that is what drives them to commit their criminal acts. That tends to be their motivation.
So let's get into Bundy a little bit. I want to make sure we get this right tonight. As we talked about, you know, offline last night, there's so much speculation and rumor and innuendo surrounding, you know, really almost every aspect of this case. I mean, if you do research even badly, I mean, that's pretty evident. So let's try and straighten some things out. Tell me who Ted Bundy was. What was his background? Who was this guy?
Well, Bundy was, I mean, even from birth, he was already at a disadvantage. His mother was unmarried when she became pregnant with him. And when he was born in 1946, of course, an unmarried mother was very much looked down upon. He was actually born in Burlington, Vermont, which was, I'm not even quite sure how far it was from Philadelphia, but his mother was shipped off to have the baby. And then he remained at the mother's home for 3 months after she returned home. The theory behind that was that his mother had never intended to go back and take him home. But apparently, due to family pressure, she did go and bring him back to the family home in Philadelphia. There's been a lot of speculation about rumors related to his grandfather. When his mother returned home, she was still living with her parents. His grandfather was apparently known throughout the neighborhood as being a very violent individual, so violent that the neighbors knew about it. They saw, you know, the way that he interacted with his family, the way that, you know, apparently he swung cats by their tails. There was a suggestion that he beat the family dog. And we're talking about a person who would go into a room and just start raging, and it seemed like he was arguing with himself. They believe that his grandmother was dealing with depression, probably from living with someone like this. But there could have been some mental disorder in the family, emotional disorder perhaps. So he already was at a disadvantage in life. He clearly would have seen the behavior of his grandfather. Therefore, family encouraged his mother and Ted to move to the other side of the country, in Washington State, where they had family. Her great uncle lived there. And so they were able to, you know, stay with the great uncle for a while before moving out on their own. And of course, later, Ted's mother, Louise, married Johnny Bundy, and Ted was later adopted. So Johnny was Ted's legal father. Some people will say stepfather, but that's not quite accurate because he did adopt him. That was how it all began.
And this will be an ignorant question, but did Ted ever talk about his grandfather? Did he remember his grandfather when he got older? Is there anything on record of that?
He did talk about his grandfather to, we know at least to one of the psychiatrists that analyzed him later, indicating that he was very attached to him. They said that he followed the grandfather Samuel around and seemed to just really kind of, maybe they had a different relationship, maybe because of Ted's youth, maybe because he was a boy. And Samuel had 3 daughters, no sons. So, you know, there could have been something different between them, but there's an ongoing theory that perhaps Bundy was angry at his mother for taking him away from his grandfather, perhaps later in life. So again, it's just speculation.
You know, for people that know about him, that will tune into this and listen to this, and they follow this case, they're going to know. But for people that might not be aware, you know, other than the number of victims, you know, that there's a certain amount of victims that fits a serial killer MO. Why did Bundy fit the mold of a serial killer, in your opinion?
Bundy was very much a stereotypical dysfunctional individual, and we find that a great deal with serial killers. Otherwise, why would they go and murder their fellow citizens?
Yeah.
With Bundy, you know, as far as serial killing, yes, he was motivated by sexuality. His victims were the objects of his interest, of his affection, and he seemed to not be able to interact with women in a way that would have interested them in him. So even though he did date later on in life, he did have girlfriends, he just, it seemed like he didn't quite get enough out of that relationship. He didn't get what he needed, and what he needed was the violence. So of course he would not have had that in a normal, what we consider normal relationship.
Yeah. And that, I guess that, that begs the question, talking about a normal relationship and what that entails and what we all know it to be. Was it a case of Bundy wanting to sort of have his cake and eat it too? And what I mean by that is, like, he wanted to have sort of like a normal relationship, you know, a basic relationship as we all have come to know them and experience them, but he wanted to sort of live another life on the side, maybe live out dark fantasies, as you've talked about a little bit tonight. I mean, was it a case of that, or was this something, was this different?
I think you've hit it right on the head. Bundy really so badly wanted to be normal. He wanted people to see him as a normal individual and somebody who would have had a successful relationship and a good job. And, you know, he wanted to be an attorney. He was very much about this image of, you know, the perfect husband and son and citizen.
Yeah.
However, we see two very different sides of him. Of course, that was what he wanted to be, but that wasn't who he truly was. He was, you know, very angry. He couldn't be satisfied with what one would consider a normal life. He needed that violence. He needed to get out that anger somehow. And the only way he found that he could do it was by stalking and killing women.
And talking about the violence and talking about that anger and needing to get that out and sort of transitioning into the victims, let's talk about the first murder that he committed, and let's talk about the victims. Can you tell us who... Can you give us a list of Ted Bundy's victims? Can you talk up a little bit about that first murder and how that first murder might have changed him, triggered something, you know, took a feeling that he had and dialed it to 11? I mean, let's talk about all of that process and what he did. Let's talk about why he killed, and let's talk about who he killed.
First of all, that's a hard question. It's very difficult to pin down who his first murder was.
Yeah.
But we did talk about a little bit last night about an early suspected victim.
Mm-hmm.
When Bundy was living in Tacoma, Washington, with his family, an 8-year-old girl who lived down the street was abducted. And at the time, of course, you know, he was 14. The police were looking at adult suspects, people who had been imprisoned for acts against children.
Yeah.
And as far as the child went, she actually was known to Ted. She was a student of his uncle. His uncle was a piano teacher. He was a teacher at a university, but he taught the local children in piano. And so Anne Marie Burr was her name, and she was his student. And so we know, of course, Ted would have seen her probably around the house. Ted also had a paper route at that time. And so, of course, 5 blocks away, I'm sure he would have crossed her more than once. He was only considered a suspect 15 plus years later because her body was never found. So she is still missing to this day.
Wow.
They never did arrest anyone for it. There were enough suspects initially, but Unfortunately, they've never been able to find out what happened to her. That very well could have been Ted's first abduction. I do wonder if a 14-year-old could have found a good hiding place, a good burial place for someone, so that 59 years later, nobody has found her.
Yeah.
So that could have been the first one. As far as beyond that, he admitted to killing as early as 1973.
Yeah.
He was only suspected in killing starting in 94. And the first victim that we're aware of survived. Her name was Karen Sparks. She was, I believe she was in Seattle in an apartment. And Bundy broke into the apartment and utilized part of her headboard, like a post, to rape her.
Yeah.
You know, apparently she remained after he left. I believe he thought he'd killed her after he had done what he felt he needed to do. And he left, and she lay on the floor for almost 24 hours before someone came in and found her. I believe she remembered a little bit of it. But of course, you know, it damaged her, did permanent damage to her internally.
Yeah.
And I can only imagine what it had done to her mentally. Beyond that, we do know that he abducted a young woman very shortly after that from her basement apartment. Her name was Linda Ann Healy. And that was also in Seattle. He didn't do much more of the actual abductions from within the home. Mm. That was the last known attack within a residence until Florida. So that was part of his early career. He, of course, took her somewhere and violated her, killed her, most likely by strangulation.
Hmm.
And her skull was found later on Taylor Mountain, which was a popular place for him. He left several victims in that area, you know, and after that, he actually began the ruse of using a plaster of Paris to put on a fake cast on his arm.
Yeah.
And he would try to lure young women to his car by saying he needed help carrying his books.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
He changed the way that he got his victims. He found that there was something happened where he believed, okay, it's too risky going into the home. I need to bring them to me.
Yeah, that's a good point, and I guess a good follow-up question for that would be the changing of MO. We see this from time to time in specific serial killers and specific men that do this. Why do you think he did that? Was it just because of the risk factor? Do you think he didn't want to expose himself to more risk than he absolutely needed to? I mean, that's a pretty drastic MO what he did, and it's a pretty well thought out MO change.
Absolutely. I do think that was a driving factor in making a change to the way that he chose to get his victims.
Yeah.
But I also think when we see killers move and change like this, we see a different way of thinking. I believe with Bundy, he was saying, I'm smart enough that I can actually lure these women to me. I don't even have to go into their homes now.
Yeah.
So I'm sure it was an ego boost thinking, all I've got to do is lure them and then I can take over from here.
I want to ask you about, I mean, I know we're kind of bouncing around a little bit, but I want to ask you a little bit about the pathology, because he was, from my research and, you know, I'm very limited research based off of, you know, what you've done, but the way I come to understand it is Bundy, he underwent multiple psychiatric examinations, and the experts, reading through like the examinations and the results of those examinations, it seems like the experts' conclusions sort of varied. I mean, there was different variations and diagnoses there. I mean, can you talk a little bit about some of the examinations he went through, what he was diagnosed with as? Can we talk a little bit about that?
Certainly. He was actually analyzed after his arrests. And it would depend on who you spoke with as to which diagnosis you received. But eventually, most if not all of the psychiatrists and psychologists came around to narcissistic personality disorder,
mm-hmm.
antisocial personality disorder, OCD, so obsessive compulsive disorder. There was only one it was the only female, she diagnosed him with bipolar disorder as a co-occurring diagnosis.
Yeah.
There's been some speculation over whether or not, you know, she was doing it for the purposes of helping him not to get the death penalty, because she was very anti-death penalty. I don't think it was personal. I think she just didn't want anyone to receive that sentence. But she later changed her mind and said she did not believe he was bipolar. She went along with the other diagnoses.
Yeah.
But yeah, he certainly seemed to fit the concept of a very garden variety psychopath.
How many people did he kill? I mean, I know even that is up for extreme debate. I know there's, from what I read, there was upwards of 30 or so that were confirmed, and there was possibly upwards of a dozen more that were potentially linked to Bundy, including the first victim that you talked about, potential victim, you know, Anne Marie Burr. But how many victims did Ted Bundy have? Do we have a confirmed number of that, or do we have a close confirmation of that?
I can give you the various answers. The theory is that he may have killed 36 to 37. That's the most realistic I've heard.
Wow.
Some have suggested over 100. I think that's a bit much based on just the amount of time that he would have had to kill.
Yeah.
He actually admitted to 20. He confirmed 20. And then there were a few he didn't even know their names. So they've not even been able to link all of the victims to him. He never admitted to the Florida victims, of course, because he received death penalties there. And he didn't want to lose the chance to overturn his death penalty.
Yeah. Wow.
So, it would just depend on who you ask. And there, you know, even individuals involved in law enforcement that spoke with him would probably have a different answer.
And I'm guessing, I know the answer to this question most likely, but I'm guessing it's probably difficult to determine how long he was active then. If he started as young as 14, potentially, then, you know, we don't really know truthfully how long he would have been active. Could have been his whole life, potentially.
Absolutely. So yeah, it's very hard to tell because he's been linked to other crimes that occurred back in the 60s. There were several victims, a couple in New Jersey, a couple in Colorado, I believe. About 2011, two vials of his blood were found in Florida. And apparently they were taken during his trials there. The law enforcement believed that they had discarded everything from the files because they'd used what they needed. But they did stumble on these, and they did try to link him to other crimes. But unfortunately, it just wasn't conclusive as far as the crimes that actually had DNA attached to them.
Yeah. And speaking of the trials, and I know that's a big, big topic to get into, too. But, you know, just the idea that, you know, he was obviously caught. He was in custody. He was at trial. Bundy actually escaped custody a couple of times, which is amazing to me. Can you talk a little bit about his escapes?
Absolutely. And I've actually been to both locations where he escaped them. They were both in Colorado. The first one was from Aspen. And there, because he was defending himself, along with other attorneys that were there to help, he was allowed to use the law library. And that was actually on the second floor of the courthouse. So he was, you know, looking through whatever books in the law library that day. There was just a police officer standing outside the door. He went on a smoke break, wasn't paying attention. And Bundy looked down, and it is a second floor drop, but based on the way the courthouse is built, it actually looks more like 2.5
stories.
And he jumped out the window and took off. I know that he had worn extra clothing that day. I don't know that he really knew what he was going to do beyond that. He did managed to be on the run for 7 days before he was caught. He didn't even make it out of Aspen. He got lost. He just could not figure out where the trails ended. He ended up all in the mountains nearby and then came back into town to try to steal a vehicle. And then when he found one, cops saw him kind of weaving and they were able to determine that was Ted Bundy, and they arrested him there in Aspen.
Wow.
Right. So that was the first one. And that was in the summertime of 1977. And then he was moved to Glenwood Springs, Colorado, which is about 45 minutes away to be held there. And he began to find his way around his cell, realizing that there was a loose screw at the top of his cell. You know, in the lights, they kind of have a screw up in the ceiling where people will go in and replace the lighting. Well, he apparently was able to remove part of the ceiling, a 12 by 12 square. And he had lost enough weight after a period of time that he was able to escape through the ceiling of his cell. And he ended up climbing down into the apartment of one of the jailers, who luckily was out for the night. Stole some new clothes. I'm sure he stole some money if he could find money there. He already had money on him that he'd been saving from friends and family who'd visited. And he did not allow himself to get lost this time. He actually stole a car. When the car broke down, he got a he hitched his way to Denver. From there, he made his way to Michigan and then to Atlanta and then to Florida. And this is over the course of about a week. Police had no idea where he was.
Yeah.
So that's when he got to Florida in January of 1978.
I can't even imagine like the amount of, I can't imagine the hysteria, the absolute hysteria
right.
with the police and this, you know, of all guys, this guy gets right. on the loose. It's like, you know, it's not unlike the police catching and losing Jack the Ripper or something for a week. Exactly. I mean, God knows what they could get out and do and how much more violent they would be in that time frame.
Exactly. Yeah. And the after effects, of course, he was able to attack more people in Florida. I spoke with one of his survivors, Kathy Kleiner, and I asked her if she was bothered or if she held any grudge against the Colorado police that didn't watch him closely enough, because if they had, she wouldn't have been attacked. And she seemed like she was okay with them. She'd forgiven them. And so that was really big of her. I don't know if I would have been quite as forgiving.
Jeez. What is it like to talk with someone like Kathy Kleiner? I mean, you talked about in the beginning of, you know, kind of going one direction with your life and your career and everything, and then going a different direction instead. And now you're researching this case, and now you're talking with survivors of one of, and you know, this is not to glorify Ted Bundy in any way, shape or form, but this is a very, very big case. It's very well known. Obviously they're making, you know, movies about it almost yearly now. It's a pretty big deal. What is it like for you to sort of go through that process and then to speak with some of the survivors of this guy's, you know, spree and this guy's rage?
It's fascinating. I've been lucky to have been able to interview Kathy twice. I did just post an article last year that I did with her on my blog. And then this year she's helping me work on a book. So I was able to interview her for that. She is a really fascinating individual. There's such a strength of spirit because she'd been through a lot by the time she was attacked. He'd already dealt with childhood lupus, you know, just feeling lost at home when her parents had to work and she was home alone while she was dealing with lupus. So she was very lonely. She had just found kind of a new community at Florida State University in Tallahassee and joined the sorority. And she had all these new friends and she kind of felt like she belonged. And when the attack happened, all of that disappeared. It was all taken away from her. And part of it was the police didn't want her talking to any of the other sorority sisters because they thought she'd forget things or add things to her story. So she had to be completely shut off. She couldn't talk to her roommate who was attacked, you know, and it was just like she was lonely all over again. And the sisters were told not to speak with her. And even after the case, she tried to reach out to them and they wouldn't talk to her, apparently afraid that it would, you know, create even more of a stigma on the Chi Omega sorority. So she, you know, again, found herself having to start over. And the fact that she's continued on, you know, she's dealt with breast cancer, she dealt with being told she'd never have children, and she did luckily have a child. And you know, she's just such a strong individual. It really gives me a lot of hope. And, you know, just strength, seeing just how she's dealt with all this. It's just fascinating.
Are you able to talk about that attack on Kathy and, you know, how she was able to survive it?
Absolutely. She actually will talk about it. She'll just, it's such a part of her now.
Yeah.
I think there are a lot of victims who want to leave something behind and forget it. But with her, she'll go into a bookstore and look for a book with her name in it about Ted Bundy. So she has, I wouldn't say a sense of humor, but she has a strength to her where he can't hurt her anymore.
Yeah.
And that just kind of inspires me when I think about that.
What was her experience with him in particular? Let's talk about that. Tell us about what happened to Kathy.
And we can put this in context. Ted had just gotten to Florida about a week ahead of this incident. So in January, again, of 1978, he found a place to live. He thought, you know, I'll get somewhere new. I'll live a straight life. I won't commit any more crimes and police will never find me, which, you know, is entirely possible at that time.
Yeah.
But, you know, just to kind of blend in, he was so far away from where he committed any crimes. And then, of course, the more time went on, he realized, okay, it's been 2 or more years now since I've had a fix. You know, an addict is going to want to return to their addiction. Yeah. And so, you know, it was almost like the early Ted Bundy came back. We're talking about someone who is very disorganized at this time. He was desperate. He hadn't had his fix. He, you know, was kind of getting to where he was, you know, starting all over in a way. So he'd been stalking a young woman who lived off campus named Cheryl Thomas. He decided he would go return to her apartment one night and see if she was in so he could attack her. Well, she wasn't there. So he became upset and then realized, okay, wait, there's a nightclub over on this other side of campus. Let me go and see if I can pick anybody up. So he went to Sherrod's nightclub, and we're talking about someone who's in his early 30s now. He doesn't look like the students around him. You know, his very early killings, he was killing co-eds, but he looked like he fit in on campus. At this point, of course, you know, after being in prison and a lot going on, he really kind of gave off vibes to the point of where nobody was going to leave with him.
Yeah.
So he left the club, and the club was right next door to the Chi Omega sorority house. He kind of watched and waited and realized one of the side doors, or the side door, was not locking when people were going inside. It, you know, how a door will bounce when it doesn't lock.
Right.
So he decided he was going to go ahead and take his chances. And when he got close to the door, he noticed that there was some firewood that had been chopped for the sorority house. This was January. So he grabbed one of the oak logs outside the door and opened the door and just walked on in, went upstairs to the second floor and just randomly chose a room, went in and attacked a young woman, Margaret Bowman, who, you know, was asleep. Nobody else was in the room with her. He attacked her and killed her, strangled her. Then he went across the hall into Lisa Levy's room and also attacked her, sexually assaulted her with a bottle of hairspray that apparently was in the room. And then again, went back across the hall. So now we're back to the room next to Margaret's room, the first room he went in. That was Kathy and her roommate, Karen Chandler's room. Yeah. And Kathy said she was asleep, but she heard someone come into the room and apparently kicked the footlocker in between the two beds. So it woke her up a little bit. And she said, I looked up and all I could see was someone standing above me holding something. And then I heard the sound of the log on my face. She didn't feel it. It was more like she heard it and it was a thud.
Wow.
When he beat her with it. Apparently he did that a couple of times, then heard Karen, her roommate, kind of making noise or waking up, and went over to her bed and attacked her. And then he came back to Kathy and was attacking her. And at the moment that he was raising his arm to hit her again, somebody pulled into the back of the sorority house, bringing back one of the sorority sisters from a date. So the car lights lit up the whole room. They always had their window open because they had plants hanging in the window. And apparently he got spooked. I think he believed that Kathy could see him and might have been able to identify him, and he ran. He had no idea that she was blind as a bat without her glasses, but it worked. He ran. At that point, he left the sorority house, ran back to the original apartment, Cheryl Thomas's apartment, and she was home, and he attacked her, leaving her for dead. And luckily she survived. Kathy and her roommate Karen survived. I also interviewed the sheriff, Ken Katsaris, who came to the scene. To both scenes, actually, came to the sorority house first. And of course, you know, was just getting briefed when everything happened. And then he finds out that there's been another extremely similar attack across 8 blocks away.
Yeah. And
just could not imagine. Could the same person have been full of rage, so much rage that he went right down the road and killed somebody else? And that was exactly what happened. So yeah, wow. I was lucky to talk with him as well. He didn't connect Bundy with the crime when he was alerted to it because the crimes are so different. So this was someone who went into a building and killed people as opposed to someone who was luring people to the car. But what he didn't know is that Bundy had started by going into a home and attacking somebody. He didn't have that knowledge yet, but it's fascinating. And the fact that Kathy can talk about it and she remembers most of it is, it's amazing.
Wow. What a story. And it's incredible. I'm so grateful that she survived that and has lived to talk about it. I mean, that's pretty remarkable. Listening to you talk about this and just looking at his case, looking at his victims, what I want to do now, and we talked about this a little bit offline last night, and one of the aspects of this case that's so fascinating, and one of the aspects of this guy in particular that I really wanted to ask you about has to do with modern day attraction to this case and Bundy in particular, whether it's his, whether it's his charm, his looks, the idea that he seemed like such a normal guy, at least, on the exterior. It seems like you can't look at this case and the pop culture influence and not see that there are an abnormal amount of people, women really in particular, that seem to be attracted to this guy. And that's one of the most fascinating aspects of the case for me. And it seems like Bundy himself maybe even knew that, and maybe that's why he was able to get away with as much as he did before he got caught. But can you talk about that aspect of the case? Explain why it is that so many people in general, but really so many women seem to be drawn to him.
I really do think it was that Ted knew how to work the media. He was able to manipulate. He was able to turn on the charm, put on this mask of normal behavior and be the person that he thought people wanted him to be. He was married to a woman that he knew from Washington. She moved to Florida. He was able to charm her to the point of where she was pretty much taking care of a lot of his legal demands and anything he needed for court. And so I really feel like it was how he used the media. He was clean cut. Mm-hmm. He was not a bad looking person. Mm-hmm. And he looked so normal. I mean, it's so hard for us to think about the guy next door who, always waves and, says hello, of being somebody who could be this dark and dangerous. And so I think that's a big part of it. I think he was very early on a kind of person who people looked at and said, that's not what the serial killer that I expected him to look like. He looks like someone who, I would be interested in dating, or somebody who's, I would like to be my son-in-law or something. That was a big part of it. And he definitely knew how to play it up for the media.
Yeah. And speaking of that, I mean, if we go bigger on that aspect of the case and we go bigger just on that in general, I mean, it seems like, so what I've come to understand, and you just sort of confirmed it about Bundy in particular, but just serial killers in general, is that like you said, they're not always obvious. I mean, they seem, a lot of them seem like they're just some dude, just some normal guy. I mean, you always hear, when you get these news reports on the radio, they always bring out the neighbor, and the neighbor always says, he was just a normal looking guy, a normal unassuming dude, I never thought anything was going on. And it seems like a good deal of these men, including Bundy, appear on the outside to be, smart, nice, upstanding people. And I guess this maybe gets into the psychology weeds a little bit here, but why do you think outward appearances can be so deceiving like that? I mean, we all seem to have secrets. I mean, whether they're bad ones or good ones, I guess there's no good secrets, but, bad ones, or whether they're just kind of just normal secrets that people keep to themselves, part of their life that they keep, sort of from everybody else. But why do you think, an outward appearance like Bundy's or like some of these other serial killers can be so deceiving? I mean, does that make it all the more shocking that they can be capable of these? I mean, here's a guy that killed 30, upwards of 30, maybe more, like as you mentioned, maybe 100 people, some people believe. I mean, what's the deal there?
I think that most people want to see the good in their fellow human. And I think that if someone's projecting that to you, you have no reason to suspect them of not being, a good, kind-hearted person. Even people like myself, who I read about this constantly, I watch, things about it constantly. It's something that I think about a great deal. It's still very difficult to consider somebody who's nice to me of being a really terrible person. Sheriff Katsara shared with me that if he had not known about the files, the crimes of which Bundy was charged with, he would have liked him. Had to keep reminding himself, this is not a good person, regardless of how friendly he seems or, nice he seems. Yeah. But I think it is just human nature to want to share that kindness with other people.
I guess as we sort of wrap up the conversation tonight, I mean, what aspects of this case, of Ted Bundy himself, the people around him, his victims. What aspects of this case do you think should be discussed more? Maybe, you know, aspects that haven't been discussed yet. I mean, what should we be talking about? What should we be focusing on when it comes to this particular story?
Well, I think we focus a whole lot on Bundy and not nearly enough on the victims, the survivors, the families that lost someone. Just considering the life that someone led before this happened, you know, so many of these young women were trusting individuals. They were raised to be that way. And that's how we should be able to be in community. But unfortunately, Bundy and other killers will use that against their prey, if you will, because they are predators. So I think we need to consider more about the families, the victims, getting justice for them, you know, as far as what their lives are like now, you know, thinking about Kathy, just considering what her life's like now, you know, she didn't get to finish college. She chose not to. And you certainly can't blame her. She did have a really good way of coping with her fears. She became very frightened of men afterwards, as you can imagine. But she decided, okay, I'm going to get over this. So I'm going to go work at a lumber yard. You can imagine. Because they're always, you know, it's always men. And she said that really helped her get through it. She also worked at a hospital because she became afraid of hospitals. And so, you know, it depends on the victim, but she was able to find a way to grow beyond the experience and not allow him to control her life. Yeah. That type of story is really important above and beyond just learning about serial killers.
So for those who don't know the ending to this story, and I have a follow-up question to this that I think is an interesting way to wrap the show tonight. But what happened to Ted Bundy?
Bundy was arrested in Florida, and he was tried for the murders of the two young women in the Chi Omega house.
Mm-hmm.
And he was also tried for murder of 12-year-old girl, Kimberly Leach, in Lake City, Florida. He received the death penalty for all three. He did sit on death row for 11 years. So he was finally brought up for execution on the murder of the 12-year-old in 1989. So January 24th, 1989, he was executed in the electric chair. I asked Kathy about that, what she thought of him finally being executed. She said, well, I was glad it finally happened. And when I heard about it, she actually said that the sheriff Pitsaris called her and told her that he'd been executed. She sat on the sofa for about 15 minutes and cried. And she said, I cried for Margaret and Lisa because of what, you know, they weren't able to defend themselves, but I was glad that I got to defend them. So just considering that relief that the families experienced once he was executed was sweet justice in a way.
Yeah, that was my follow-up question. Did that execution, in your opinion, bring justice?
I think it did. I don't believe that the death penalty should be used in a lot of cases. But with Ted, first of all, we know he did it. We know the bite mark evidence on one of the Chi Omega victims linked him definitively to her murder. And he admitted to 20 crimes or more. So we know he committed the crimes. Of course, you know, in that case, I do feel it was justified.
Do you think people will ever stop studying Ted Bundy, this case in particular?
Well, I can tell you that I won't. So I think he will always be fascinating in a sense because of the time in which it occurred, because of the very normal persona that he gave off to the media and those around him. And I just really think that, you know, I think we can learn from people like Ted. He taught me not to trust anyone, in order to keep myself safe. So, I think there's a lot to be learned. There's so many rabbit holes you can go down with him and you can pick it apart. So I'm glad that I'm a part of creating content related to Bundy based on what I read and, you know, even based on my opinion, because I feel like I'm helping others learn and, you know, kind of finding a place in history for the survivors and the law enforcement that worked on his case.
Yeah. Well, before we get out of here tonight, you know, it's funny. I told a few folks that friends of mine that I was going to have you on the show. We're going to record. And every single one of them said, do not let her leave without asking her to give her thoughts on Extremely Wicked, Shockingly Evil and Vile and the Zac Efron Netflix film. Let's talk about that. What was your thoughts? What was your thoughts on the story, on the source material? Just kind of us your thoughts on that film and how you thought Zac Efron did in that role.
Well, OK, let me start with that. Zac did an excellent job in that role.
Yeah, I agree.
His physique is a bit different than Bundy's. He's a larger shoulders.
Yeah.
And he was a bit more petite there. But
athletic. Bundy was athletic.
Mm-hmm.
I did think that he did a great job channeling the character. However, the movie itself was almost completely fiction.
Okay.
I understand that it was based on his girlfriend Liz Klepper's recollection of the crime.
Yeah.
You would do better to read her book, though, The Phantom Prince. She just republished it. They had not been publishing it for a long time, and it's just been put back out there with a new chapter from her daughter.
Yeah.
But yeah, I understood the concept, but it's really so much of it is fiction that I had a hard time enjoying it.
Hmm.
The Ted Bundy tapes documentary is a lot better. It was the same director, which is interesting, Jim Berlinger, but it really gets down into, you know, the interviews with Bundy, some of the law enforcement that worked with him. It talks about the victims. I would recommend that above and beyond the Zac Efron movie.
All right. Well, we have a professional review of that film. I know people are going to want to, if they haven't seen it, I mean, they're going to want to probably go out and check it out just for the curiosity of how Zac Efron did in the role. But
sure. And
yeah.
I posted something on my blog about it as well, so they can read my review there as well.
Great. And speaking of your blog, what are you working on right now? You touched on a project you're working on with Kathy that's Kathy helping you earlier in the conversation. Tell us what you're working on now. What's coming next for you?
No problem. So the next thing I'm working on right now, I'm actually working on a book about Bundy. I've got a fellow author who's working on it with me as well. His name is Fabian Richard. He is going to help me with the French version as well.
Mm.
So it'll be in two languages. It's called Ted Bundy Memories of the Beast. It's really about the victims, the survivors, the families, the law enforcement and the attorneys that interacted with them. And we're having them select a picture or more than one picture and kind of talk about how it relates to Ted Bundy in their life at that time. I think that'll be really interesting once we get that completed. We hope to have it published probably the end of next year, 2021.
All right. We'll look for that. Now, as we exit the show tonight, we want to, of course, end our discussion with a very well-known tradition here on the show that, of course, began in France, actually, with the creation of this questionnaire by French television host Bernard Pivot, and it was made famous here in the States by the legendary interviewer Mr. James Lipton. Now, there's 10 questions in this questionnaire. Are you ready to go?
I'm ready.
All right. Let's start off the same way we start every one of them. What is your favorite word?
I had to think about this one, but it's anathema.
What does that mean? I've never heard that word before.
If something is anathema to you, then it's something that's despicable, something that you don't like. It's a fun word.
Yeah, I like that. I like that. I learned something new tonight. What about the opposite? Right. What is your least favorite word?
Pus.
Pus. That's a good one. I hadn't actually thought of that one. Everybody says moist, which is interesting. So, you know, but I hadn't pus. I had forgotten about that word. That's a pretty bad one, too. All right. Number three. What turns you on?
Intelligence. There's something about, and I'm a huge David Bowie fan. There's something about his lyrics. He was extremely well read. I just find, you know, any type of intellectual is something that's going to draw me to them.
What about the opposite? What turns you off?
I would say somebody who is willfully ignorant and just chooses not to learn, chooses not to understand, to investigate anything. That's probably the biggest thing.
Yeah. Unfortunately, there's a lot of that going around.
Right.
All right. What sound or noise do you love?
I love music.
Yeah.
A lot of different genres, actually. Not just David Bowie, but, you know, alternative and opera and just regular classic rock, just a bunch of different types of music.
Yeah, I can't argue with that. What about the opposite? What sound or noise do you hate?
I'd have to say my alarm clock.
That's the first, you're the first person that's given that answer, but that's probably the most obvious answer, though. Yeah, the alarm clock has got to be one of the worst. Yeah. Okay, well, number seven is everybody's favorite question to answer. What is your favorite curse word?
I love saying fuck.
Doesn't everybody? That's got to be, by far number one since we started doing this. Yeah, it's right at the head of the pack.
Nice.
All right. What profession other than your own would you like to attempt?
I think I would love to be a musician. I took piano as a child. I took flute, oboe, and piccolo. So probably would love to take more piano lessons.
Wow. A fellow musician. I played the clarinet and the trumpet in high school. Nice. So yeah,
I can
appreciate that. Okay. What about the opposite? What profession would you absolutely not want to attempt?
I would not want to be involved in the clergy.
Yeah. Yeah.
For... Just don't think I'd have, no, that wouldn't work for me.
There's a lot of reasons, I'm sure. Yeah.
Yep.
All right. Well, speaking of clergy, this is, you know, always maybe the most poignant of all questions, but, or the most profound, I should say. If heaven exists, what would you like to hear God say when you arrive at the pearly gates?
I would like to hear her say that all the dogs that I've ever loved are there waiting for me.
Man, a woman after my own heart. Yes.
Exactly.
100% agreed. Okay, on that note, EJ, tell us where we can follow you online. Where can we find out more about your work? Plug your blog, your Twitter, all that jazz.
All right. My blog is at bundyfile.com. That's BUNDYPHILE.com. You can find me on Twitter under Rose Dysfunction. The reason for that is Ted Bundy's daughter's name was Rose or Rosa. And again, you know, just reach out to me there if you have any questions or you just want to talk about Bundy or true crime. So I'm working on a new article for my blog. I've just finished 2 podcast scripts for the Our True Crime podcast.
Nice.
One on Marianne Holder, who was a family annihilator, and one on Mary Clement, who was a family poisoner. As far as what's coming up, really, I'm just trying to focus on the book. I may be looking at launching a podcast. That's still in the works.
There you go.
Might be coming down the pipeline.
Well, you know, links to everything that you just mentioned and everything we've talked about tonight in the show notes for tonight's episode. This was really an education. I mean, for me, I part of the reason why I wanted to reach out to you is because I was ignorant to the case of Ted Bundy other than, you know, pop culture reference and just what I've seen on, you know, the Zac Efron film and just in documentaries and things of that nature. But I really appreciate you taking the time tonight to sort of educate not only me, but educate our listeners on who Ted Bundy was, you know, a little bit of his motivation, talk about the victims. This was really enlightening. So thank you for your time. I appreciate it.
Excellent. Thanks so much for having me on, Chris.
If you made it all the way through our conversation tonight, I want to thank you for hanging out with me and my friends. We hope you've enjoyed the show. Please visit us on social media as we post each new conversation as they air. News, show information, and more. Go to facebook.com/meandmyfriendspod. On Twitter, you can search the handle MeMyFriendsPod. And on Instagram, search the handle @MeAndMyFriendsPod. If you enjoyed our conversation tonight, please do me a favor and head to iTunes and rate us and leave us a review. As a brand new podcast, we need all the help we can get, and your time is appreciated. Me and My Friends is produced by Vanessa Williamson and edited by me, Chris Williamson. The opinions on Me and My Friends are those of the individual guests and may not reflect those of Chris Evan Films, Inc. Chris Evan Films, Inc. is not affiliated with the films or clips referred to herein. Any audio clips used in this podcast are the intellectual property of their respective copyright holders. They are included here for the purpose of education and entertainment, and no infringement is ever intended. Me and My Friends is an exclusive trademark of Chris Evan Films, Inc., and may not be used without the express written consent of Chris Evan Films, Inc., all rights reserved. Me and My Friends is a Chris Evan Films production, copyright 2020, all rights reserved.